All right, welcome to the Retro Game Club Podcast, Season 2, Episode 24, also known as Episode 56. Broadcasting with me from an empty arena is Hugh.
Yeah, I got all of Soldier Field to myself right now.
Yeah, we're actually in, viewers can't, or listeners can't see us, but we're actually in separate empty arenas.
Yeah, that's great.
They actually just imploded the Palace of Auburn Hills, which is by my house. So one less empty arena.
Who played there?
I saw the Pistons. The Pistons.
Oh, the Pistons played there. Okay.
Yep.
Well, they're not going to be playing there for a while anyways. So.
Yeah. So what's going on?
Not a lot. I've been, I decided I was finally going to try the Uncharted series because I have all four of them. And I looked up on howlongtobeat.com and saw that they are only 10 to 15 hours each. So I said, okay, that's like a month if I play each game, you know, an hour and a half or 2 hours a night, right? So got through the first game already, which indeed it is pretty short. And yeah, I like the story. I mean, kind of a cool story. The combat's kind of annoying. Not a big fan of how they did that, because most of the time it's like you enter an area and like 20 dudes are just shooting at you and you can't see where any of them are.
That gets a little bit better.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope it gets better in the later games, because that part is definitely annoying. And then a lot of falling and dying, which is fine. You know, Breath of the Wild was a lot of falling and dying also. Although if this game was done in Breath of the Wild, it would be a lot easier.
Yeah, yes.
Because Link can climb any surface.
This, I think it's a great series, and I think it's one that, like, a lot of people say number two is the best. I think, like, two and past are all equally great. So, yeah, a great series. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I like the story. I'll put it that way. I like the story a lot. Because, again, it's just Indiana Jones, kind of. I mean, the guy's a little maybe less ethical than Indiana Jones, but kind of the same character, you know, similar adventures. So it's cool. And it influenced what will be my pick of the episode later on.
Yeah. And you know they're making a movie of it, right?
I heard that. Is the guy from Bones playing Uncharted guy, being that they look exactly the same already?
No, the guy that plays the newest Spider-Man is. So it's going to be a younger version of, what's his name, Drake?
Yeah.
And you know who's playing the older guy? What's his name, Sully? Mark Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg is playing an old guy.
Yeah. Oh, man. He was originally supposed to play Drake. And then they moved him up, which I think could be good.
So Mark Wahlberg, who is, hold on, who is not yet 50, he will be 49 this year, is officially old enough to play the old guy in Uncharted. That's great.
Yeah, I think they're starting it young because I think they're hoping to have a lot of movies, kind of like they did with Pirates of the Caribbean. So.
All right. Awesome. What have you been up to?
One strange thing happened today. Right before we started recording, a monsoon came through my area in, Michigan. And I don't know if it's, I think it's all of Michigan. I don't know if it's all of the country, but in, this is more for our not American listeners, but every Sunday at noon in the summertime, they blast the tornado sirens, to make sure they work. And this storm hit at exactly 12 p.m. So we didn't know. We were like, what do we do? Like, is this a coincidence? Or so that was kind of strange. Other than that, been playing some Final Fantasy Remake.
Okay.
I like it. I really like it. I'm exhausted today because I was up late playing it. And I caught that, I think I mentioned this in the previous episode, I caught that Ninja Gaiden competition, a speedrunning competition. I forget exactly what it was called, but it was, you're instantly eliminated. So you play against everyone, the person with the lowest score is gone, you play against everyone again, minus that person, you keep going until no one's left. And it went 12 rounds. Yeah, Arcus won, and it was a lot of fun watching that. A lot of great players, and I also watched part of a Super Mario No Glitch, No Warp speedrun today. It was pretty good.
So speaking of Uncharted again, I feel like Final Fantasy VII Remake is more like Uncharted than it is like Final Fantasy VII.
I would agree. It took me a while to get used to the fight mechanics. I almost fell off it right away, but it just took me some getting used to. Because there are some hidden JRPG elements in there, in the fighting.
Yeah, depending what you do, because there's like different fighting modes in the game. Mm-hmm. So you can make it more like an action game or more like a turn-based RPG.
I just left it at whatever the default was. Oh yeah, and very boring news, but I think if anyone I'll ever speak to would like this, it's our listeners. I got one of those Genesis Sega CD 32X power bricks that's all in one, so you don't have to have three giant bricks, and it works.
So you bought like the Sega branded one for the 90s, or just
people make new ones now.
Okay, yeah, because that's why I have the one that's like, you know, made by Belkin or something, right? Mm-hmm. That is just a power strip, because I had one of those and it exploded.
Yes, no, not that kind. Yeah, so this is a new one that someone made, and so I have a lot more space in that cabinet now where I have that plugged in.
Yeah, so I bought two of those. I think one I bought is Belkin, and the other is probably the company that makes the big APS devices. I can't look at my power strip from here, but yeah, basically just power strip with more space between the holes.
No, this is just a power brick with three circular, I forget what they're called, ends off to plug into the Genesis. One of the most boring things you could buy, but it's the little things in life, right?
I actually think that's pretty essential if you're going to play a lot of video games. If you're going to like run a lot of retro consoles, you have to have big power strips with giant gaps. Otherwise, you're going to have like a daisy chain of power strips.
Oh, no, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the actual DC converter for the Genesis 32X and Sega CD. How there used to be three you had to plug in?
Yeah.
This is just one thing that has
three. Oh, I thought you bought a fancy power strip. Okay.
No.
So this is some device that powers three devices at once.
Yeah, it powers the Genesis, the 32X, and the Sega CD all at once.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not what I was picturing.
Which is not just as easy as a Y cable, because like one of those threes has a negative 5-volt instead of a positive 5-volt, and yeah, very strange. So, again, probably the most boring thing we could talk about, but if anyone would appreciate it, it would be our listeners.
Yeah. All right.
News.
Yeah, let's just dive right into news here. A designer of the NES dishes the dirt on Nintendo's early days. Not super early. It's a 100-year-old company.
Yes, but 71 to whenever he left. But he designed the Famicom, and he got brought in before that. And it's a very nice interview on Kotaku talking about their rationale of the Famicom, why it looks the way it does, what the culture was like in the company. And seems like a very nice, obviously intelligent guy. And I think any retro gamer, this is a must read. It's not very long, too.
Then also on Kotaku, 7 Sonic the Hedgehog prototypes you were never meant to play.
Yes, but a lot of us played a few of these.
Right. Like they talk about Sonic Crackers, which, of course, everybody has played.
Yeah.
It's not very good. Have you played Sonic Crackers?
No. I've seen video of it, though. For our listeners to try to picture this, it's like Tails and Sonic kind of tied together with a rubber band, but it's called Ring Power or something like that.
It's kind of
each other back and forth.
Yeah, I think it became Knuckles Chaotic, which is the worst Sonic game, debatably. But there's other things here, like the Nick Arcade version of Sonic 2, which seems to be a build where something happens after you collect however many coins you had to collect in this Nickelodeon game show that I was too old for when this came out, so I never
saw this. I never heard of it either.
It's a challenge. I guess you try and get 25 rings, and the people playing it are completely horrible at Sonic the Hedgehog. Have you watched this?
No, I didn't. I only saw the picture. I didn't watch the video.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Neither of them can play Sonic the Hedgehog at all.
And some other kind of prototypes of Sonic CD and 2 and 3 and... Yeah, kind of a...
Probably the version of Sonic 3 that's like all Michael Jackson songs is out there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see. Then you have this weird duct-taped Game Boy Advance Raspberry Pi thing. What is this?
So, yeah, this looks exactly like a Game Boy Advance, and you put a... it has a 3.2-inch screen, and it takes 2 AA, and I think you could put your rechargeable batteries in there if you want, but you put a Raspberry Pi Compute engine in there, which is a form factor of the RetroPie, or sorry, Raspberry Pi. You could, yeah, do some RetroPie or Laka action on there. And we were talking about this before the show. The presentation of this is not very good. It's like the model they show that you could buy looks used, very used for no reason at all.
Yeah. Not okay. It doesn't look good. can I just leave it at that?
Well, I like the idea. It looks like a Game Boy Advanced, but used. So I don't know. I haven't watched a video with sound, so I don't know if he's gonna explain stuff that makes this look better, but we'll let our listeners make their own decision on this one. And it's $176, too. It's kind of not cheap.
Right.
You ready for a big home project? To build your own Star Wars cockpit arcade machine?
Yeah. This is a cool project. I could never do this.
Yeah. So just so our listeners know, this isn't from scratch. You would buy the stand-up, one-up arcade Star Wars arcade machine from Walmart or wherever you would buy them from. And then you can, with a bunch of wood and artwork and a lot of time, make it into a sit-down arcade cab. And yeah, it does look very nice. I would not have the patience or the room in my house for this.
Right, and I don't know how to use a saw, so...
Yeah, I would cut a finger off, for sure. what do we got next? Oh, Turbo Petski Fighter. So, this is a, I think, new C64 game, and I just wanted to link to it. It kind of looked neat. I don't know much about Petski. It has something to do with C64 characters, I guess. Maybe some of our UK listeners can clue my naive American brain in about this. But it looks pretty nice. I couldn't find any video.
I think also in the Apple II, I could be wrong. It's been a long time since I've done Apple II programming. Like, you have your set of ASCII characters, and then you have like some, you know, Commodore added some additional characters that are kind of like, you know, crude shapes, so you could draw like lines and stuff with them. Some of these characters are like the low, you know, the ASCII set has some of these, albeit in different positions. Mm-hmm. So it's really just like, think of it as, you know, fonts, but they're shapes instead of letters.
Yeah, like, yeah, no, I get it. I didn't put ASCII and Petski together. So,
So it's a game made using all the graphics, you know, our text. It's just using the Commodore font. That's what it's saying.
And making like a Street Fighter 2 like game out of it.
Yes. So it would be like making a game. You do web stuff, right? It would be like making a game out of Font Awesome.
Or, yeah.
What does Bootstrap use? Does it use Font Awesome or does it use something their own proprietary thing. I do Bootstrap stuff all the time, and I don't know this.
Yeah, I don't know either. I might use SVG or something, yeah. But, huh, yeah. I wish there was video of this. I couldn't find any.
Yeah, I didn't see any either. So let's see here. Shantae's Game Boy Color game is getting a re-release.
Yeah, so hopefully you didn't just recently purchase this for $10,000 on eBay, because that's what it was going for.
Yeah, well, that's what they were asking for. I think there's a big disconnect between what people ask on eBay and what they actually get.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, this is like, I've probably played an emulated version of this. I like the later games a lot better. It was a very good game for its time, of course. But it's, you know, kind of, I don't know. It's a Game Boy Color game. Like, it doesn't, like, the control isn't super incredible, and I feel like they really improved it in later iterations. Mm-hmm. It's not a bad game. Like it's a very good game for the hardware it's on.
Yeah, yeah. But again, you're not going to spend $4,000 for an open box version of it.
Right, right.
So did it say what it's actually being released on? Switch and Xbox One. There you go. Yeah, we have a lot of Nintendo news as well, which I forgot to put our first article in our Nintendo news segment. But CBR has a look back at the Lion King platformer from the 90s, just really talking about how it was brutally hard and how that was a demand by Disney to the developers, because they wanted it to be too hard to beat if you rented it from a video store. So, if this game frustrates you, that's why.
Yeah, that's interesting, I guess. But would you all? What? How would this make the game longer?
Yeah, yeah, it's not like they're running out of space, probably.
I have to look, but, you know, it could probably get up to like 4 meg or something. It would probably only use up half the available space, is my guess.
This is a very nice-looking game, though. I've never been good at it.
let's see, a mod to take a Super Nintendo and turn it into a Switch dock, if you want to ruin a perfectly good Super Nintendo.
Yeah, this is a project I never want to see in person. So this person tells you how to, take your Super Nintendo and you could charge your Switch with it and then never play Super Nintendo games with it. I guess if you have a broken Super Nintendo, do this, maybe?
Yeah, yeah.
We talked about a few episodes ago about a Mario 64 PC port, and mm-hmm. now it has a 4K texture pack for it. So if you downloaded this before it got taken down, I'm sure there's still ways to get it. But
Did we establish what country this person is from that Nintendo has not managed to completely wipe it from the internet?
No. It could just be on torrents, though. But wow, this 4K, yeah, palette or 4K textures just look great.
What else here? Oh, article about the Legend of Zelda manual and how it actually like explains how you're supposed to play the game and has a backstory. I remember this because I have the Legend of Zelda manual, and first time I played through it, I actually read the manual. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how you get through the game without having read it sometimes.
And that's what they say in this. It's like perfectly written, where it gives you the background, it draws you into the game, and it also tells you a lot of the obscure secrets, but not all of them. It still leaves you stuff to discover.
Yeah, it has maps for like some of the early dungeons to kind of help you get started. But it was just a different era. Like, you know, games didn't have built-in tutorials. I mean, obviously, Legend of Zelda today would be very different, right? There'd be, like, you know, an old guy that drops in via parachute to occasionally give you tips. And then once you've sort of mastered that, then you get fewer tips.
Yeah, this is kind of a lost art. We have another Mario 64 mod that uses the Xbox Kinect to control Mario. This seems like a horrible way to play Mario 64. But in the video here, there's a guy on a trampoline, and he's doing a Mario 64 triple jumps. It does not look fun.
Yeah, this seems like the worst idea ever.
But I have been gaining some weight lately, so maybe I should get into something like this.
Yeah, yeah. What do they say? On average, people have gained 15 pounds this year so far?
I believe it. I lost a ton of weight in the beginning of lockdown, and I gained it all back. So I'm even Steven. But we have a really really interesting topic this time.
Yeah, fresh off not having a topic. We now have a very long, very good topic.
Yeah. We interview Dagan Brock, who created the GS Plus, which is an Apple II GS emulator. And he also created Flapple, which is a Flappy Bird for Apple II, which kind of went viral a while ago when it came out. And he's actually written a lot of things. Please enjoy.
All right. We're here with Dagan Brock, creator of an Apple II GS emulator called GS Plus, amongst other things we'll talk about. Welcome to the podcast, Dagan.
Thanks, you guys. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Let's just start from the beginning of GS Plus. What made, why the GS? Do you have a, like nostalgia for the Apple II GS?
Yeah, I think probably a lot of us have a favorite platform or two or three. And at this point, you know, I don't really get into the old school platform wars because I can kind of see them all for their benefits. But for me, the Apple II GS was kind of the last platform that I could cling on to that had a usable desktop interface until it pretty much got deprecated to the point where you were forced onto something else, right? So for most people at that point in time, let's say early 90s-ish, you'd probably be forced to choose between an IBM PC and a Macintosh. Mm-hmm. So the GS was really the one. And I kind of walked away from it for many years after that because it was actually painful to give it up and go to platforms that I thought hadn't really evolved as much. And I chose PC because I felt pretty burned by Apple as a corporation, and they weren't exactly innovating either. And, you know, so off the shelf PC stuff, which was just, it felt a bit like a step backwards, like, great, now I have a CD-ROM, but I'm trying to program this thing, and programming for graphics cards back then on these various different specialized memory layouts and things like that, it was kind of a nightmare. And I thought, this is really supposed to be the future. So, I kind of put that stuff in the closet for years. I think what actually got me back into it was looking at some of the early available 2GS emulators, which really Kegs was the big one. And I need to call out that that's what GS Plus is based on. I didn't write that completely from scratch. Kent Dickies wrote the Kegs emulator, which was pretty impressive for the time. And then there was a site at the time called the Apple IIgs Gaming Fairway that was really cool because it was a very well-curated sort of love letter to some of the titles that people would know for the Apple IIgs that were really, you know, the flashier ones that actually took advantage of the platform. And today that site's called What is the Apple IIgs? And that's probably a site people are familiar with, you know. Yeah. And it's got these great screenshots of the covers and everything. And so enough time had passed that I could kind of get back into it as like, you know, I'm not going to pull out my computer, but I'll get the emulator running on here and play some of these games because absolutely still, you know, a fun thing to do. You shouldn't let the past get in the way of your enjoyment of something, right? Just because you've moved on. So it's not exactly a nostalgia, I would say. It's almost the opposite, where I kind of said, you know, I can do this again. And really that led into GS Plus because Kegs, you know, the author had walked away. He's a actual brilliant professional who has better computer things to do, even though he's resurfaced a little bit lately. So the problem became just... That's like all software, if it's not taken care of over time, it starts to kind of get crusty and broken on the edges with modern operating systems. So it had certain dependencies, for instance, on macOS. I want to say it was the Cocoa APIs. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even a Mac person at that point in time. So things like that, dependencies on X Windows, and you know, not a lot of people are running X Windows as their primary desktop these days. So really, I had my own private builds of a lot of this stuff for years, and I decided, you know, I'm going to just make the effort to actually get this back running cross platform, make updates to the all of the sort of virtualized layers that you would have in an emulator, which is all your input and output, right? The keyboard, mouse, sound, video, most of that is now handled through SDL2, the simple direct media layer. That's a pretty common toolkit. And honestly, most of the work I have done has actually just been around making it cross-platform, getting it to build. curse you, Windows. You're awful. No. I mean, I run all these OSs. If I could, I'd probably choose Linux as a daily driver, but I work in enterprise, so I'm mostly using OS 10 or whatever they want to call it these days. But I'm an equal opportunity OS hater. But at the same time, you look at other emulation platforms and other computers, and some of them, their domain is very well covered. The C64 has just a really impressive community, and part of that has to go back to the sales numbers, but also the sort of staticness of that platform and how many there were, and the minor differences between them versus, you know, the Apple II, actually very similar throughout the 8-bit platform, but there were a lot of firmware revisions and things like that that, you know, oh, now I have to not touch this one specific area in memory because that's used for, say, holding mouse pointers on some systems. And so, you know, you actually had more variance there, but when I got into the 2GS, man, we were really behind. The emulation was behind, and there, like, I felt like I personally knew all of the remaining Apple 2GS programmers that were active, because at one point it seemed like there were about 5. And I don't know, you guys are very involved in this scene, so you probably have a better idea than I do. Are we kind of in a renaissance where maybe, I don't know if it's because of age, people are going back to it more, and now I also see second generations interested in writing emulators as a starting project for their programming?
I think it's a few things. I think it's, you hit the first one, and I also think that a lot of like SD card updates and like hyper card accelerators are being made. It's just easier to create things for old products now. And then I think it's also, there's so many programming tools because we're standing on the shoulders of giants that it's easier to create these things now too. Hugh, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think the number of devices that you can create emulators for now, or let me rephrase that, you can run emulators on, I really think like Raspberry Pi is a big reason why there's a renaissance in emulation right now. Yeah, I just think, you know, Raspberry Pi is like, you're not going to be able to run the latest Call of Duty on Raspberry Pi, but if you want to do some really awesome gaming projects, you can run, you know, every system. Raspberry Pi 4, I think, is up to Dreamcast at this point.
No, that's true. I guess I forget about that a lot of this isn't necessarily targeted at, you know, Ryzen, Threadripper, giant systems, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of people really trying to build these as standalones, and that is largely where I've been focused again, is trying to get the tooling up for people to be able to develop, because that's one thing, if you did it back in the day, you know, it was like a little bit painful if you wrote something and it crashed and you're looking at like a minute plus boot time back into an assembler. So, you know, I'd typically sit there with a notebook back then and like write down the few bugs that I thought I was going to fix on the next pass, you know, assemble, run again, maybe get a little further. And now that, you know, it's really takes 1 second to assemble, boot the emulator, see my stuff on the screen, our iteration cycles are better. But a lot of the 2GS tooling didn't seem as advanced as a lot of these other platforms. So I've tried to spend a little time there. And again, I'm not necessarily always the author. Maybe you guys have heard of the Merlin assembler for Apple II. There was Merlin 8 and then Merlin 16 by Glenn Breeden and published by Roger Wagner. And then that was a really popular assembler. And they actually, I think, had a Merlin for Commodore 64 as well. But Brutal Deluxe is a French team that did Merlin 32, and they just wrote it in pretty bog standard ANSI C for Windows. So I asked them, are you guys cool with me porting this? So now we have Merlin 32 that you can run on Mac, Linux, and Windows, because they're very, oh, we only do the Windows. And that's fine. You know, that's their prerogative. I want people to be able to feel comfortable to do that, and I'll use my attention to get the ports for everybody else. Similarly, they did a Cadius disk image utility, and I made sure that has ports that are available on GitHub now. And then I've kind of extended that, and I've started putting those tools into GitHub Actions. So with GitHub Actions, if you guys are really into the dev stuff, it's all about continuous integration and continuous delivery. So every time I make a code change, I should be able to verify that my code still builds and everything. And I, you know, do that locally. But now it's to the point where somebody gave me a bug report for Flappy Bird. And I'd kind of known that the vertical blanking code on the Apple IIc was not correct. It's a, because the IIc came with a mouse or the ability for a mouse, they really changed vertical blanking and supported things like mouse interrupts. So you're kind of, I tried to write that and I kind of did a half-assed job, and it worked on some of the IIc firmwares, but I think it was like ROM 4. Again, I'm telling you, there are a lot more Apple IIs out there than you realize. And so Cucumba, a brilliant programmer who's well-known for his LZ4 compression work and for Total Replay that he's put together with 4AM, that's a giant game compilation. And he does a lot of clean cracks and ProDOS ports so that you can run old disk games off of images. Anyway, he told me about a bug in the vertical blanking stuff. So when I fix that bug in my code, I just fixed it locally. I kind of checked it locally, but then I just push it to my GitHub. And now my GitHub repository for Flappy Bird, actually, when I tag a new version, it does the entire build package and release for me. So if you look at the releases page on GitHub for Flappy Bird now, like, I don't even build that locally. It's all taken care of by virtual machines provided by GitHub that run Merlin 32 and Cadius to assemble. So yeah, we're building our 8-bit code in the cloud these days.
That's crazy.
Yeah, probably not what Amazon intended when they came up with some of these tools, but yeah. I think GitHub, yeah, GitHub's owned by Microsoft. I think
Microsoft, yeah.
It's Microsoft, so they're actually running on Azure machines. But what's great about that too is that this is also what I use for Buckshot, that image tool, which that now uses under the hood this program called BMP to DHGR, B to D, we'll call it that. For the image processing, it uses another tool called Cadius for the ProDOS image, which I think I mentioned a second ago. So then we also have the desktop application written in C++ using the Qt framework, Qt 5. And so if I want to build that for Linux, Mac, and Windows, I have to build the desktop app for each one and those two binaries. So that's 9 separate things I have to build and package together. And it took probably a month of managing to get that into GitHub Actions. But now, again, the version of Buckshot I just released, whenever I commit code, it builds it for all systems. And not only that, it's using the underlying tools that are built for all the systems. So it takes a long time to get there. But the problem is, if I don't do that, what happens is I get a bug report 2 years down the road that, like, oh, hey, this looks weird on my high resolution Windows 10 desktop. And I was like, oh yeah, I never tried it on that high res Windows 10 desktop. So then I can find the bug in about 5 minutes, but then I have to spend 2 hours to 2 days to get all my build VMs back up and running for Windows, Linux, and Mac, make sure that the Qt version on there is the right version. So it's, I'm trying to go faster because it's just me doing a lot of this tooling. And again, I'm trying to support all the OSs because I don't want to see, it just seems silly that in 2020, like, a command line utility would only be built for Windows or Linux, especially one written in C. And in fact, other languages like Rust and Golang allow cross compilation. So it's just kind of no excuse. The problem comes into the desktop apps and graphics. And so if you're not targeting something using like SDL or OpenGL or Qt framework, it gets really hard to do cross-platform. And I feel that burden is unfortunately heaped on just developers like us that don't have a lot of resources. And don't get me started on the actual packaging and distribution of apps and signing. You know, I have to, if you want to run on Windows 10 or Mac OS these days, you have to basically forcibly tell it, I'm really cool with GS Plus running, because both of them will not allow you out of the box to run it because I'm not signing it. And I gave up on paying those taxes years ago because $100 a year just to publish, you know, I used to have a really cool 6502, 65816 reference app on the App Store. And I didn't want to charge people for it, you know, and I had to, and it's not like charging made any difference. It just meant that I made back like $20 a year out of the 100 that I spent on the license. And that's where I'm just really having a hard time with modern development. And so they seem a little bit antagonistic towards developers as far as, hey, I'm trying to support your platform and put out not software. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I swear?
We can usually do tweet, but sorry.
Yeah, take it out. That's fine.
What we should tell our listeners that it's not the original Flappy Birds you wrote. It's a. I'll let you tell the story of it.
Oh, yeah. No, it's just another port. There was a period in time where, of course, Flappy Bird was still pretty hot, and what was it? One of those subreddits that does retro gaming or something was kind of doing a retro Flappy Bird week, because I believe there were already some versions out there for like maybe BBC Micro and C64 or whatever. So I actually worked at the time doing digital advertising on platforms like Facebook, and, you know, did a lot of virtual currency stuff for that. And so sorry about all the farm bill notifications and all that shit. But anyway, but I was also working on a lot of other things. Like, you've seen recommended news articles that are actually like links to ads. I did all that stuff, not really like trying to scam people, but just building the engines for a lot of it. And I was very aware of how virality worked. And so there were two things when they were talking about Flappy Bird. There was no Apple II version. And I was afraid that somebody else might come along and kind of throw something together and basic, and just to get one out there for this Flappy Bird week. And that's fine. But what happens to people unfamiliar with your beloved platform is they start comparing apples to oranges. Like, oh, the C64 one that's written in assembly using sprites versus the Apple II one that's written in basic. And they're just going to be like, this sucks. And that's not the case. You know, each platform has people that are very familiar with the ins and outs. And can push it a little better. So part of that was really not like, oh, this is going to be the best Flappy Bird, but I wanted to at least have some goals there. And I'd always thought that at 1 megahertz, I had the memory bandwidth to do that double low res graphics mode that I used for that and do it at 60 frames per second and use vertical blinking, which most Apple II stuff really does not. You can't do it prior to certain Apple IIe machines. So it's, Flappy Bird isn't written for a 2+, but so it was really largely for that. I was afraid that somebody else might come along and do a crappy version, and people would be like, the Apple II is just not a great machine. And then the other reason, like I said, I had some ideas about performance that I could hit, but overall, I just knew that if I do this reasonably well, people are going to be like, oh, look, Flappy Bird, Apple II, you know, and send it around. And sure enough, and it was one where I kind of put it out there and all the Facebook groups or whatever, and they're like, ah, cool. And I was like, yeah, I'm happy with it. It's cool. Like, I knew I could have kept polishing it and made it nicer, but it was good enough. And it blew up for like 3 days and then died down. And then I don't even remember. I woke up one day, went to work, and somebody's like, hey, congrats. I'm like, what are you talking about? And it was just all over Kotaku and TechCrunch and all the, like, and I don't, why would TechCrunch cover it? That's how viral the Apple II is, though, right? Anything involving that, you know, it's like the Steve Jobs rare on eBay. It's just, so I hate that I did that, but it's also, I think, hilarious and also proved my point to myself. And I didn't do it with a crappy product, so it's not like I was, you know, just doing it to troll the whole world. But I think it's funny how those things blow up. And again, you know, GS Plus is kind of a footnote in comparison. And I spent so much time trying to make that thing better, but that's how it is. You know, you don't do it because you're trying to get famous. I'm really in it for what I hope will be a good dev platform. And also, I feel like we do owe some of this work to the future, because it's getting harder and harder to experience these things. And it's a little different than previous generations, where mechanical things could be pretty well described, but some of these systems are so complex that without good sort of representation of what really the logical underpinnings are and fixing a lot of those bugs, they'll never know. So, you know, getting back to emulators, I think a lot of us are very concerned about how good we can get with CRT shaders, because CRTs are dying and we're really struggling with, you know, so now we have these high resolution displays, but they're not exactly 60 Hertz in the same way, but there's some new technologies around that. And what I mean is that I can generate an image at 60 frames per second, and I can double buffer that and switch it during the vertical blank. But if your monitor refresh rate is slightly off, which actually HDMI typically is, it doesn't exactly match. Now I forget what the new thing at TrueSync. There's a new technology there, right? So if you could get something like TrueSync, what you could do is then actually with a really fast renderer, try and render it at the time that the display is really requesting it. But this is like really getting into the nitty gritty, right? So that, I think, plus high DPI displays, you can start doing subpixel artifacting of what I think is missed on a lot of the CRT GPU shaders that people do. Like Zellin does a really good one for NTSC that, you know, if you know about the WAS color, it actually can simulate that, and some other people have. But what they don't do a good job of is, and this sounds really stupid, so you'll forgive me, the mesh, right? Like the screen that actually goes underneath, it's called the shadow mask, right? So the shadow mask basically has a ton of tiny little holes in it. And I think that we can actually emulate some of that a little better, where it contributes a bit of darkness in between the pixels, but it also allows for that same bleed over. But right now, a lot of times it just looks like a blur effect when you see people doing it, because I think they're missing that part. And so that's the thing. I spend a lot of time thinking about this, but I have this darn day job. And so I can't spend a lot of time in pushing that forward. And I think, and it's not me, right? I think the fact that emulation and retro gaming is where it is through the contribution of tons and tons of people wasting and toiling their hobby hours away trying to push this boulder up a hill, but it is getting better.
Right. Because you kind of solved, like, when it comes to like Apple emulation general, like a lot of the major problems are solved. So the things that are left are these really, really small, very difficult problems.
It's almost always timing. Yeah. Most, like GS Plus and Kegs have they don't very accurately represent timing. And part of that is because of when the emulator was written, you would take shortcuts and just say at this next point, how many cycles have passed because of the performance. Kegs really comes out of the 1990s. Nowadays, there's so much performance that you can do a lot more. And so if you're familiar with how a lot of computer timing actually works, say, the 2GS is something like 2.8 megahertz, but the crystal inside is actually at 14 megahertz. So 14 divided by 5 gives you that 2.8, right? But the thing is, there's other things in the system that are clocked off that same primary crystal. So you don't want to write an emulator that simulates 2.8 megahertz if you want it to be accurate. You want it to run an emulator that simulates the 14 megahertz and actually does the clock division for all those other subsystems. Now that I know that, I'm like, oh, crap, I've got to write a new emulator. But it's interesting, right? I mean, it is this process for me, too, where I think a lot of people, I stumbled into the emulation aspect, trying to just get it ported and get it better, and then wrap my head around, you know, emulating the instructions of a 65816 processor is easy. It's well documented, all 256 instructions and how much time they take. Modeling that in a physically real timing scenario is where it gets hard. So I'm learning, you know, as I do this. So it's enjoyable. It again gets frustrating that I can't just, you know, become independently wealthy and work on this 40 hours a week, but such is life.
How often do you do releases or plan releases for GS Plus?
Somebody, I think, said that the other day that it was, they thought it was unmaintained. So not very often. So actually, I'm glad you brought it up, though, because GS Plus is not dead, and there is some news around that. The last major release of GS Plus was the last one that I was still building it using my own GitLab pipelines, and my GitLab pipelines actually triggered builds on my own in-house virtual machines. So I've kind of switched all that stuff to the cloud. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happened in that time period was there was another developer who was really contributing some interesting and good work. And they were doing it in their own fork. And I asked if they were okay with me bringing it into GS Plus. And they said, that's fine. You know, it's kind of out there, but if you're cool with it, go with it. So I did that. And part of that was because I had spent a lot of time getting that last release done. I think it's 0.14. And I had to switch to other projects. You spend so much time on one thing, you kind of starve all of the other projects you want to do. And so I had to give some other things some new, some updates and fixes, you know, go back to raising my kids for a while and working and earning money. So I really just started kind of every once in a while merging in these new features. And then I also took on the build system that they were using. So I was using a pretty old-fashioned make system, and you had to set it up per OS. So if you wanted to make it on Linux, you use this make file. Windows, a different make file, et cetera. And they were using CMake. And I know this sounds like I'm getting into really unnecessary details, but this is, again, where I think there's some antagonism towards development and developers. Mm-hmm. So I took in the changes for CMake. And one problem is I'm an idiot. I don't know anything about CMake. I've learned a lot about it since, but this was a completely different system. And part of CMake is it's supposed to kind of help you find dependencies, like, oh, I'll find where the SDL library lives on your system for you. You don't have to tell me exactly what directory, which is great until it can't find it. And I'm not great at forcing CMake to do what it doesn't want to do automatically. And that's the point. You're not supposed to. It's supposed to do it automatically. This all wraps up to the person who contributed the code was definitely, they're actually a better C programmer than I am and C++, and they knew what they were doing. I took it in and could still build versions, but I also check some things that other people don't. So I was still supporting Cygwin on Windows. And that's kind of really hard to do these days. Uh-huh. And that broke. So at that point, I tried to get CMake to work with it. And so here's the news. The news is I actually have a separate branch where I've been somewhat rolling back some of the changes and working on moving this to a continuous integration pipeline on GitHub Actions as well. This will allow me to make releases faster in the future. However, I am also deprecating Cygwin. There were two Windows builds. One used Cygwin to largely do things like standard out through a sort of Cygwin console. And also the SDL was in an SDL just kind of blank window instead of a Win32 window. So there were two Windows versions, and having deprecated the Cygwin one, I have to kind of go back and make updates to the Windows one. And that really means modernization and probably spending a little more time with Windows than I would like, but that's okay. You know, it's worth it to move this forward. The other thing is that at this point, you know, it's largely functional. And this is kind of the frustrating thing too, because I'm very stubborn about making releases for all OSs. It really is just Windows that is lagging behind here. I've had Linux and Mac builds with bug fixes for probably a year now. And I don't have a maintainer, and it's hard. And like I just released that other program today, and I told you how many different builds it takes just to get that for three OSs, 9 separate apps really. So, you know, part of that is maybe I do bite off a little bit too much for a one-man dev shop, but it will come. The other news is I can't announce it, but I know of other efforts being made by someone that look really good for a very nice Apple IIgs emulator built top-down over the last year in private. I wouldn't be surprised if that maybe heard more about that in the next month or two. So keep your eyes out for that. And part of that too, I've been talking to this person and saying, hey, you know, when you're ready, because this will be a Windows effort initially, let's get the community on porting so that A, you can keep going if you want to on Windows, but it should be on all platforms. And they're cool with that. So I don't know. It'll probably be Windows first though, but, that was part of it too. I was kind of holding back for a while trying to get these other projects caught up and saying, well, you know, maybe they'll come out with one and I won't have to ever work on an emulator again because they'll have solved Windows or 2GS emulation, because that's really the goal. We only have to solve it once for the most part and to get all these inaccuracies out. So yes, we'd have to keep it up to date for future OSs, but if somebody has essentially a good C core or C++ core emulator or Golang or Rust, doesn't matter, some systems language, then we can probably take that into the next 50 years and have it modeled correctly.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
But yeah, if anybody wants to be a maintainer and knows about building cross-platform software, that would be great. You know, a lot of it too is about modernizing the code where, again, it relies heavily on things like logging to the console. And I'm kind of stuck on, should I even be doing that in 2020? But I really like Unix systems. And so I like that. But these are all the choices. There's a big one. One of my pet peeves with emulators, and you'll notice in GS Plus, when you want to adjust the settings, you can hit F4 and it goes into this sort of Apple II looking menu. So it takes over your main screen. You can also configure it from the command line or, you know, through a config file to set up what disks are inserted and how much RAM it has and things like that. A lot of emulators have some sort of UI wrapped around them. And gosh, do I hate that, because emulator authors probably make the worst UIs I've ever seen, and they need to stop. So to that end, a couple of years ago, I gave a talk, because this is also in GS Plus, there's experimental code for a remote debugging system that you can connect to through a socket. And I wrote a whole Qt app that was a desktop app. And the idea there is that if you have remote debuggers built into your emulator, the UI can be detached, and it could be a cross UI, so you could plug it into any other UI. But I think there were some other things I was going for there too, which is that we could have common debugger interfaces and set breakpoints and things like that, read memory locations. And I, you know, you could literally connect to it while it was running with a Python script and start injecting graphics into this graphic screen. You could do whatever, you know, through the remote thing. And I'd really like to bring that back. And it seems like now this idea is catching steam with other emulators. And I'm glad. I mean, I wish I could say, like, I caused that to happen. But I'm pretty sure a lot of us invented this in parallel, because it's what you would do in modern development. You have something like, I guess, Visual Studio or Xcode. You create a process that you're wanting to debug. You run it, and then you connect to it, and you kind of control it through that connection. Mm-hmm. So I hope we see more development there, and I'd like to bring back that code to the forefront, because the other thing about that is that once I decoupled the UI, it really made me think of something else really interesting that isn't solved well on a lot of UIs. So when you play video games for the Nintendo, you plug in the cartridge, right? And it makes sense to have a UI that says, just pick a ROM. That is not a great user interface for the Apple IIgs. Mm-hmm. On the Apple IIgs, you may have a desktop with many programs installed, or you may want to have it pre-configured to boot the Arkanoid 2 floppy mm-hmm. with black borders already set or something like that. You know, you may have some, and it may, to do that, it may need to be booting slot 5. So I kind of took a key from things like VirtualBox, and I made my interface actually allow multiple machine configurations. So you could say, I want a 2GS with 4 megs with this disk image inserted, and I'm going to call this one Arkanoid. So whenever I want to play Arkanoid, I've got a shortcut to just that one, and it's going to boot it right into that. And what was neat about that too is I integrated it with my screenshot feature. So if you took a screenshot while it was running, it knew that VM, you know, you could actually see it. So point there being that you get a lot of power when you decouple the UI. And if other people all sort of had this standard interface of, let's be able to call emulators this way and start them with these flags, maybe full screen, whatnot. And that's kind of how MAME is. But I think they need to take it a little further with some other things, where I really like the remote debugging thing, because then not only could I start the Arkanoid 2 thing, I could say, oh, and also open this debugger window, and it would just connect to the socket on there. And I don't know. I want to bring it back.
Think, I think WinUAE, I could be wrong here. I'm sure listeners, please correct me, but the Amiga emulator for Windows, I think it does something similar to that on the game side where you could choose a game from Internet Archive with specific settings, like what kind of specs in your Amiga you want to be running, you know, certain settings for certain games, and you could essentially just launch the game from the web.
Yeah.
But in the emulator, yeah, some pretty cool
features. Well, this is also, I mean, this is why there's like 20 different DOSBox launchers, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same type of problem, I guess.
And see, that's, I guess, where I've been too, tunnel vision on largely the Apple platforms. But I'm glad, again, because I've played with WinUAE and DOSBox, and I haven't really touched either probably in over 5 years. So not recent experience, right? And I'm sure they're very, very much changed and picking up a lot of these sort of features you expect from a modern system.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, DOSBox kind of, I would say DOSBox core isn't, but the community has built many, many different front ends that sort of solve this problem. Like, hey, I want to play this particular game in this configuration, you know, because to be kind of blunt, like DOSBox configuration is kind of a nightmare.
Well, I do see a shift too, where early emulators, it was really cool if you could even get, you know, Vice to run a C64 game at 15 frames per second or Nesticle to play a game. And that was really cool. I think we have largely shifted to modern emulators actually being a lot more interested in emulation accuracy, but also in that sort of development area. So you'll see a lot more features now like debugging and heat maps, built-in sort of symbol table debuggers that have nothing to do with playing a video game. You know, it's only there for coders because I think a lot of us are trying to scratch that itch of making these modern environments. And to that end, it sounds like there are a lot more people working on things like language engines for Visual Studio Code and things like that, so that you can have really nice support for your 8-bit or 16-bit computer of choice in Visual Studio Code with debuggers, symbol table lookups. I mean, it's really getting quite advanced. And so in some ways, I was actually more bleeding edge probably 3 years ago, and it feels like there's so many different efforts now that I'm pretty much just staying focused on 2GS and documenting that and trying to get that emulation up to speed and hopefully eventually get back to teaching people how to program for it.
All right. So every time we have a guest on the show, we usually ask them to pick a game of the week that we encourage our listeners to play. Is there a game you'd recommend everybody go out and play?
Okay. So I can't say Legend of Ease, right?
No.
I heard you guys like that. That's one of my favorite 2GS games for the soundtrack. And I actually talked to the developer of that or one of them. And unfortunately, the C code for the 2GS version has been lost to time. I'd love to do a better version of that. The game of the week, though, if you've never played, my pick for game of the week would actually be Short Circuit by David Schroeder. He's really well known for Dino Eggs, and I want to say Crisis Mountain on the Apple II. Short Circuit, what I really like about it is it's a bit nonlinear. So there are something like 9 levels, and only the first 2 or 3 are opened at first. As you beat 1 or 2, you kind of can go up to like level 5. So you can skip around a little bit. The other thing is it's surprisingly modern sort of platformer gameplay where you have different sections in each level that, you know, sometimes you have to avoid dots bouncing around. Sometimes you're trying to travel along circuit traces and avoid electrons hitting you. At the end of every level, there's this sort of bonus round where you're being chased around by floating electron or vacuums that can suck you out. And the whole thing is designed to be like you're trying to save the world inside this computer. So you're shrunk down on this computer circuit board. And I always love the idea of like, you know, tiny person in big world where, you know, the world is like a giant bedroom and you're just the size of an ant or something. So I would check that out. It's actually surprisingly interesting. And if you play it on an emulator, it works really well with the gamepad for the most part, and is pretty easily beatable if you really sit down with it for a couple of sittings.
Yeah, it looks like someone has already made a launcher for it on archive.org.
There you go.
Nice. Well, great. Anything you want to, anything you're working on you want to plug that you haven't mentioned yet?
No, you know, there's a just a huge, the community for Apple II has actually grown quite a bit in the past few years. So I feel like it's finally caught up and there's a lot of people working on a lot of great stuff. I brought up Total Replay, which is a great one. There are people working on other really good emulators. I did, if you're into the Apple II GS and want to start programming for it or the Apple II, I do have some videos on YouTube that cover some of the simple aspects of getting into the monitor and entering your first program. And I will hopefully get back to that series. And then for the Apple II GS, I run a site called apple2.gs, and that's the number 2 and then a period, and GS is a domain. So I've just recently updated the library there to include what I believe to be the most exhaustive book collection for Apple II GS programming. And that's I will great. Also call
it a link.
Yeah. I'll also call out my friends from Brutal Deluxe, just because they're so heavily Apple IIgs focused as well. They also include a lot of extremely early Apple IIgs documentation from back when it was called Cortland. So I have all the official stuff. I haven't really mirrored everything they do, but they're great guys. They also did the Cadius tool for disk images and the Merlin 32 assembler that I was talking about earlier. So. And of course, got a shout out to my boy, Jesse Blue from Ninja Force. We'll get back to doing some demo coding soon. Talk cool. to you soon, buddy. Yeah.
Cool. All right.
All right. Thank well, thanks so for joining much. Us. This is really great.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me ramble. Sorry. I kind of don't really have any focus. I'm everywhere. That's no, why it takes no, me no, so long. Yeah. Oh, cool. And I really do want to... someday revisit Legend of Ease. Man, I like that game so much. I never got to beat it. So I got into, I think it's like this Hall of Columns or something. And I found a bug there or something. And I got trapped in there in my save game. And it was like too distressing for me to start over. But I will do it. Columns. It's like...
Probably, I mean, there is towards the end of the game, a puzzle where you have to like break a column on the outside of the tower you're in.
And I think game, that's what it was.
Yeah, the game is really bad at telling you that's what you're supposed to do.
Well, I think I was at that point going through a walkthrough, and that's how I figured out that I was like unable to do what the walkthrough said. But it could also be like an intentional bad crack punishment. You never know.
Oh yeah.
Never know. I got to revisit that game, and I just bring it up because I know I heard that you guys were talking about that, and I was like, wow, I do, that is a really good game, and it's one that I think is doesn't show like all of what a 2GS can do, but it shows that it could have a decent port. And one of the reasons I want to redo it is because this is classic of ports for those games. They would come from the PC and use the EGA palette without modification. Yeah. It's like, you could have picked a nicer palette, guys. Come on.
yeah, it looks exactly like the DOS version, which is EGA. Yeah.
No big deal. All right. Well, cool. Sorry. Like I said, I tend to ramble, but I do like that game. So you guys take care and reach out anytime. If you need any other links, let me know. But most of the stuff is on my GitHub, or really that Apple IIgs site pretty much is a good way to find me.
All right. Cool.
That's great. Thank you so much again.
Yeah. Thanks. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks.
Take care.
All right. Thank you, Dagan, for that interview. I will be following a lot of his projects. Very cool stuff. And he's definitely smarter than me. I'm just going to come and say that right now.
I would say that, too. But for in my case, that's a very low bar to achieve.
Well,
want to talk about some Game Club games?
Sure. Yeah. Mine was a simpler one. We'll dive into that one first. Skate or Die. I specifically played the NES port of this, and I chose it just because it's kind of a summer game. And I always wished I was good at skateboarding, but never was. And yeah, this is created around 1988 this is Ultra, right? So Konami and EA. You play a skateboarder that starts out at a skate park, or at a skate shop, and you compete in various events like the high jump, freestyle, which is another half pipe event, the downhill race, and then jousting as if you were a an American gladiator. And I do really enjoy this game. The controls are a bit stiff, but it gets better the more you play. You get used to it. For some reason, I'm horrible at the high jump, which should be the easiest one.
Should be, yes.
What was I going to say? It takes a while to get the downhill down because, at least for me, because when you hit jump, it takes a while to actually jump.
Yeah.
It's really frustrating. You really have to plan ahead, but, you could do some really creative things. You can, cut some time off by jumping over water where you don't think you can, or groups of rocks that don't look like you should be able to jump over them. And, I would say my favorite part is the jousting, but it's probably because it's the part I'm best at. And if you go on Wikipedia, they actually come out and say that this was directly inspired by the game 720, which I'm shocked that 720 or that Atari didn't sue them for all this. But this does have a sequel, and this does have a sidequel called Ski or Die. I did not play that one. And I really like the NES port of this. The Apple II GS port definitely looks the best because a lot of people don't realize that the Apple II GS is almost exactly a Super Nintendo. So, you know, it just looks a lot better. DOS is okay, but I would just stick with the NES port of this. Did you get a chance to play this one?
Yeah, I play this on NES. I like the downhill racing best, probably, even the... Like, you have to relearn the controls when you play it.
Mm-hmm.
The controls are really kind of goofy, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. And then I like the joust event, even though it's super easy, right? I mean, pretty much every opponent in joust you can beat the same way.
Yeah.
There's like one or two moves that work every time. I did not get a chance to. There's like a couple Game Boy versions also that are... different, let's just say. Like, they have some events that are the same and then some differences. And I know the sequel is more like story driven because I guess a plot is what was missing from Skyrim. Like, that's what we needed was more story. But yeah, it's a fun game. I mean, it's like where there's six different events and, you know, three or four of them are still a lot of fun today.
This is one I would like to see ported to the 2600, simply because last year when you picked California Games, mm-hmm. and that seemed to be the best version of it, I'd like to see what they could do with this.
Yeah, not much, I bet. Yeah, I don't know how that would turn out.
Only one way to find out.
But yeah, like the high jump, I don't like that event too much. It's one of the ones I pretty much never do.
Well, and also, they only count your last jump. So you go, what, five times in a row, but only your last jump counts. Your first one is only to make sure you still have momentum. So often, your second or third jump is your highest. So that's kind of frustrating, or, I don't know, it's not something I would have done. I would have just taken the highest jump, but maybe that's how that event really was in the 80s. I don't know.
Yeah, I suspect there's probably some, what's the word I'm looking for? Programming laziness behind that.
Yeah. But I definitely give this one a recommend. It is fun. How about you? Let's dive into your game.
Oh, yeah. I went with Donkey Kong Country just to celebrate the fact that it is now on the Switch, if you have a Switch Online thingamajob. Now, I didn't play that version. I actually played it on the Super Nintendo Classic because I happen to have a save game on there already. I really like Donkey Kong Country is a game I like a lot, especially with the soundtrack. I mean, it's not just like one of the best soundtracks of the Super Nintendo or the 90s, but I mean, like,
you know, like Aquatic Ambience is arguably one of the best video game songs ever for any system. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's got this, and even some of the, like, the Jungle Music's great. Like, the whole soundtrack is really amazing, and it's one that I listen to quite a bit. The game is, you know, going back and playing it, the game is a lot harder than I remember. And it could be that I'm just less good at games now than I was in the mid-90s. But I have a lot of cheap deaths in there. Like, one, you don't really have more than one hit. Like, there's no life meter. And the later Donkey Kong Country games, I think the modern ones, like the 3DS one and then the Wii U Switch one, you actually have, like, hearts. Mm-hmm. You have two characters, and each character has 2 to 3 hearts. Whereas in this original one, you might have two characters at a time, and they each basically have one hit.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a lot of cheap deaths and not a ton of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, opportunity to earn more lives. Mm-hmm. So like Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze, you die a ton, but it's really easy to get 99 lives.
Okay.
So, right. So that's maybe the downside to the game is a lot of cheap deaths. But overall, I mean, I do like the game. I like the music, the settings. Have not finished it on the Super Nintendo Classic. I think I did beat this back in the day. But man, now it's about like the third world and I'm getting killed a lot.
Yeah, I've been playing this on the Switch online thing, and having the instant rewind has really made this game better for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've rewound the same spot like 5 times just to get it perfect. And especially the, what are those called? The minecarts. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the minecart levels are super cheap. I mean.
Yeah, it's memorization. If it's the first time you're playing it, you're not going to get through it. Period.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you have to memorize the course. And sometimes there's like hidden, you know, if you're trying to get like all the Kong letters or, you know, any of the other hidden items, it's really, really hard.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, that's a really nice quality of life feature. And I also use the save states. I played this game a lot more than Skate or Die this week. I like Skate or Die, but I just...
Yeah, Skate or Die is kind of shallow compared to it, right?
Yeah, in having the save state and the rewind really just made it this game more accessible to me.
Yeah, maybe I should just go back and start it on Switch again for the rewind feature, because then I don't have to worry about banking extra lives.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Less frustration. What are you gonna do for the next episode?
Yeah, so after playing a bunch of Uncharted, I think I'm going to go with Montezuma's Revenge. Probably not, like, the most culturally sensitive name for a game nowadays.
No.
That's what it was called. Whatever. And this is a game that was on a lot of 80s systems. I mostly played the Master System and Apple II version. But it's on, like, ColecoVision. There's a 2600 version. All the different Atari computers have a version. And, you know, Uncharted is sort of like high-tech, the first Uncharted, because the setting at least, is like a high-tech version of Montezuma's Revenge, where you die a lot. And there's a lot of weird cheap deaths from cliffs and stuff, which, again, I don't actually mind. Like done right, that can still be fun. Like, if you have unlimited lives, I don't really care about a lot of cheap deaths.
There is a few comparing videos on YouTube if listeners want to see which port they want to play before they actually dive into it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're all very similar. I mean, some just look better than others, of course. Mm-hmm. Some of my Kinect controls, like I don't know if I want to try to play this with a ColecoVision controller.
Oof, yeah.
Like 2600 might actually have better controls. It's sort of like, it reminds me of the Angry Video Game Nerd game. Like, again, you just kind of have to memorize patterns for each room and, you know, perfectly execute a series of jumps and stuff to get through each room. We'll talk about it in a week, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, I still really like, it's funny, I still like this game. Like, I like the idea, I like the setting, and yeah, you die a lot, so maybe find a version where you can cheat to get unlimited lives, or just play it on an emulator. which is what you can do anyways.
Yeah, that's probably what I'm going to do. I don't know if I own this one. I'll have to look.
It might be. Do you have like the ColecoVision flashback?
No.
Oh, okay. I think it's on there.
No, but I have boxes of 2600 cards, though.
Yeah, I don't have this on 2600. But I believe it is on the ColecoVision flashback, which is almost worth getting the system for by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking at the game list. It's on there. All right. And you're going to pick our guest game?
Yeah. Short Circuit. So I'll link to various places our listeners can play that at. But like you said, it's already playable on archive.org. So not a bad place to start for it.
You want to, let's get some email. I can get the first one if you want.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Yeah, so first one is from Joe. He says, E-Series was very helpful if he ever decides to give the games another try. He was interested in it back in the day when he saw Eastbook 1 and 2 for the TurboGrafx-CD and also for the Master System. Of course, what he noticed right away was the unusual name, which he thought was pronounced like Yees? I don't know. And did not learn the correct pronounce. I can't pronounce how he thinks it's pronounced. That's what I'm saying. It looks like something Kanye West would call himself. and he said he didn't hear the correct pronunciation until he saw it on G4 TV. And they were talking about the PS2 games. Interesting. Hmm. I think we only got one in America. For Skate or Die, this one caught his eye when it was new, because it sort of tapped into the whole like late 80s, early 90s skateboard trend. He was always been confused by the controls of it, though. So it really was not something he got into too much. And I agree, the controls are still kind of odd. And yeah. Donkey Kong Country, he still has a complete in-box copy along with the promo VHS tape that Nintendo Power sent out. He remembers during in the Console Wars book that they noted this as this game as being like a turning point in the 16-bit wars. Not sure if that's true, but the graphics and sound were very impressive and still hold up. He also calls out Aquatic Ambience as one of his favorite pieces of game music ever, which, yeah, it is. He actually prefers the first one over some of the later ones, even though they have some like extra additions.
Yeah. I have the later ones. I just haven't played them yet. I have the too many games problem, which is a great problem to have.
So that's another one where if you want to get Donkey Kong Country 2 and 3, you can get the Super Famicom version for way less than the Super Nintendo version. And it's not like you need to know a lot of Japanese to play Donkey Kong Country.
Yeah, no kidding. Stanley writes in. He recently discovered the show, and it looks like he's going through the older episodes, which we really appreciate. He rented Uniracers several times back from his local Blockbuster, and then one day it just disappeared, never to return. It was probably the summer of 95. He wonders if it was the lawsuit from Pixar that we mentioned in the episode. Probably, right?
I don't remember that game actually getting pulled from shelves.
They just stopped making them.
Yeah. I don't know how often Blockbuster got rid of games.
Or I wonder if Blockbuster and Pixar were both somehow part-owned by Disney, and then so it was like a protest or something.
Wait, was Blockbuster part-owned by Disney?
No, I don't know. They were part-owned by Comcast.
Right. I could see Disney Comcast like saying, hey, if you want to get Disney films, you have to pull. I don't know. It seems.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know. I have a hard time with that, too, though. I don't know.
But Stanley, to answer that for you, it remains a mystery. I don't know. But that is funny. But he mentions that, yeah, one day there are three copies and then the next day there are none. And he brings up dummy boxes in Blockbuster, which is what I forgot they did that to make it look like they had more copies of stuff than they did.
Right. You'd have to look behind the dummy box to see if they actually had the game.
But, yeah, looks like he's moving up from episode 25. So, yeah, I hope you keep emailing us. And, Joe, thank you for that email, too. Email at retrogameclub.net or find us on social media, facebook.retrogameclub.net or Twitter at RGC Podcast. And yeah, please keep those emails coming. We've been getting a lot of new listeners lately, and we hope you guys go back to the early episodes, and we hope you write us and play these games with us.
Yeah, I forgot what episode we did Uniracers on. And I think it's been a while.
Yeah, that would have been 25 episodes ago at least. But it is a good game.
Yeah, so just to let you know, when I saw this email, I actually had to go back and Google the Pixar Uniracers lawsuit because I forgot about that angle. And I'm sure we talked about it for 10 minutes.
We probably did, yeah. We only recorded this episode a few days after our last one, so not enough time to get social media organized. So, sorry, Zach.
Yeah, it's okay.
It happens, yep. Well, I think that wraps up episode 56.
Yeah, so thanks for listening.
Thank you.